You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So, reading M.K. Asante's prose, which is a great experience, it changes the rhythm of your thinking, of your hearing. M.K. tells it like he saw it, like he heard it, he smelled it, like he felt it. He doesn't pull punches. There's his mother, as delicate as eyelashes. There are fiends at the window of a house in South Philly and cracks stashed in a mattress in an alley. He's a boy trying to be the frog that gets a jump on the boil, who stays alive on the mean streets. His life, he writes in his memoir, Buck, quote, was like that bus in the movie Speed, where to stop meant to die. On the pages of this remarkable memoir is an homage to the blank page as a starter pistol to the message our protagonist heeds, to let the beauty of what you love be what you do. Yes, you'll hear about that tonight from our very talented and accomplished young guest, M.K. Asante, and our wonderful moderator, Jeff Chang. M.K. Asante was, according to his father, the first American to be born in Zimbabwe, where his birth to a distinguished American professor of African studies and his choreographer, dancer wife, was, quote, celebrated and praised throughout the country. He's an award-winning writer, filmmaker, hip-hop artist, and professor of creative writing and film at Morgan State University. And to interview M.K. tonight, we invited Jeff Chang down from Stanford University, where he is the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts. Jeff knows hip-hop like the back of his hand or the bottom of his sneaker. He's the author of the award-winning Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, what Time magazine called the, quote, funky bootleg B-side remix of late 20th century American history. I know you'll want to ask both of them questions. Please welcome M.K. Asante and Jeff Chang to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hey, what's up, y'all? What's going on? How y'all doing? Thanks very much. We wanted to just give an appreciation to the LA Library Foundation for having this amazing Aloud series. And please feel free to give a hand to them. You guys are all here for this.
What's up, everybody? How y'all doing?
Yeah. So let's just get started, man.
Cool.
I am really, really honored to be here with M.K. Asante, author, poet, filmmaker, father, teacher, professor. The first time I met you, I was like, man, this guy is like royalty. Because, you know what I mean? Because, like, your dad is like Malafi Asante, who, for folks who are like my part of the hip-hop generation, the older side of it, we all had read Afrocentricity. I think it was a huge influence on folks like, you know, KRS-One and Public Enemy and all these folks. Yeah. And your mom was the director of the Zimbabwe National Dance Company.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, this dude's like royalty. Like, what do I say to him? And I get, you know, the thing that's interesting to me is all that backdrop. Yeah, and I did, and we hit it off, and here we are. But that's like a whole backdrop to this amazing book, Buck, which is, it really changes the game, I think, in a lot of ways as a memoir for folks of you call it the post-hip-hop generation. It's beautiful, it's lyrical, and it's a powerful, powerful narrative, and I wanted to get into that. But I guess, you know, the question that I had is, what is it like, you know, growing up in that kind of a space? And how long did it take you to feel like you could give your own story, that you could tell your own story to the world?
That's how I felt when I met you, by the way. You know what I'm saying? Jeff Chang, Can't Stop, Won't Stop. We love you.
But no, thanks to everybody for coming out tonight. I like looking out, seeing a lot of diversity, different ages, different races. But, you know, for me growing up, and this is what I talk about in the book a lot, you know, it was this kind of duality, this complexity, because on the one hand, you know, you got my pops who's preaching Afrocentricity. And then on the other hand, you know, you got my brother who's in and out of jail, in and out of the system. On the other hand, you've got my mom who's struggling with mental illness. You know, the time when they had me in Zimbabwe when I was born was really a very different time than when I grew up, you know, in Philadelphia. And so growing up in a house with all these different, you know, mom, you know, suffering from prescription addiction and my dad not there and my brother in and out of jail and all of these things, like, so it was a lot of complexity, you know what I mean? It wasn't just like one way or this way.
Because you were like conceived like during the independence movement,
exactly.
Right, in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they moved there. My parents moved to Zimbabwe. You know how some people, you know how some people talk about moving back to Africa? You've heard of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my peoples, you know, they were actually the type to do it. You know what I mean? You know, mm-hmm. So they like, no, let's move back to Africa. Yeah, let's do it. So mm-hmm. they moved back to Africa, and they did it at a time when Zimbabwe was fighting for independence. And so they were a part of that movement. That's why they went there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it was interesting because there's implicit in the book is sort of this unpacking of all of that, you know, I guess to me, coming in from the outside, this glorious kind of history that's going on.
Yeah, let
as
me,
you're talking about it.
Let me actually read some stuff I got.
Please.
To give you guys a sense of like the story. So this is the opening of the book, chapter one. Each chapter has a title. Chapter one, The Fall. The fall in Philadelphia. Outside is the color of cornbread and blood. Change hangs in the air like the sneaks on the live wires behind my crib. Me and my big brother Uzi in the kitchen. He's rolling a blunt on top of the source, the one with Tyson on the cover, rocking a koofy, ice grilling through the gloss. Uzi can roll a blunt with his eyes closed. He cracks, splits, busts. Yo, Malo, the rawest crews in Philly are all three letters, he tells me. I read the cover through the tobacco guts and weed flakes. The rebirth of Mike Tyson. I'm not good, I'm not bad, I'm just trying to survive in this world. Awaken crews in a rude fashion, on the ass like Mike Tyson at a beauty pageant. Now those are lyrics that are in the book, right? I do this all the time. Spit lyrics to songs under my breath, all day, every day. The bars just jump out of me no matter where I am or what I'm doing. It's like I got hip-hop Tourette's. He dumps, spreads, evens. JBM, Junior Black Mafia, of course us, UPK, Uptown Killers, PhD, Play Hero and Die, Uzi tells me. He tears, licks, raps. HRM, Hit Run Mob, EAM, Eerie Ave Mob, ABC, Another Bad Creation. Folds, rolls, tucks. Another perfect blunt. That John looks like a paintbrush. Now hold up, let me explain to y'all. John can mean anything, person, place, or thing. Sometimes if we're telling a story and don't want people to know what we're talking about, we'll plug John in for everything. Like, yo, the other day I was at the John around the corner with the young John, right? We get to the John, right? And the nigga at the door on this John, right? Not knowing I had that John on me, man, it was about to be on in that John. So, you know, that's from the beginning. And one thing I tried to do is like introduce like new language or language that people hadn't heard of. That's where I'm from, you know, like John, for example. It's like a very, I mean, if you're from Philly, that word is like, you know, it's like in your bloodline, you know what I mean? So I wanted to introduce those things. Let me talk a little bit about my brother real quick. Uzi is the color of walnuts and has a long, sharp face like the African mask my dad hangs up everywhere. His nickname is Da'u. My parents call him Da'udi, and the hood calls him Uzi. He's got a bunch of other names too, like some superhero. Uwap, Da'u, Uzito, Wap the Culture, Cool D, Pinch P, Big U, Barkalark, Drop the Miss Rhyme, Big Fly, and Stilt the Kill. and let me just get a little more, because this my brother's a very important character in my story, in my life. So in the beginning of the story, in my memoir, basically my brother's friend comes and they have a stolen car. We call it a Johnny in Philly. It's like, yo, we got a Johnny. Let's be out. And of course my brother is like, let's go. You know, my brother is like 17 at the time. And I'm a kid, so, and I want to go too. And so, and this is how it always goes. Me following Uzi in everything, everywhere, like his little black JanSport, covered in marks a lot, strapped tight to his back, koala style. Anywhere, any place. He does it, I do it. He tries it, fuck it, I'm trying it. He can't shit, why can't I? Sometimes I even duck like him under doorways, even though he's way taller and I don't need to duck. I guess I just do it because Uzi's more than my big brother. He's my idol. I don't care that he's taller and older and smarter. I wouldn't even really know his age if old people weren't always bringing that shit up, talking about, you can't do this, you can't do that. Why? Because he's 16 and you're 12, they say. I follow Uzi to sweaty Badlands house parties that always end in crazy shirtless rumbles with everybody hollering, North Side, North Side, in the middle of the street. To Broad and Rockland to cop dime bags from one of the dusty bodegas with nothing but baking soda and expired Bizquick on the shelves. To freestyle ciphers on South Street that the nut-ass police always break up for no reason. To crack on Jones getting off the L at 69th Street like, yo, shorty, let me holler at you for a minute. To scale the fence to watch Sad Eye, the Jordan of streetball hoop at 16th and Susquehanna. To skate the ledges and steps at Love Park until we get chased away by the cops. To bomb the Orange Line subway with Sharpies and Kiwi polish sticks. And now, to joyride through Philly in a stolen wheel. Being with Uzi makes me feel invincible. Like nothing bad can happen to us. Like nothing and nobody can hurt us. I feel unfuckwittable. So...
These are not words that you'll see in most memoirs.
Word.
What were you trying to do there? Like, it seems like you're trying to break open the form a little bit, the memoir form, and kind of mess with it. Also represent, too. I mean, in a sort of hip-hop sense, right? Represent your family, represent the neighborhood that you grew up in.
Yeah, man. I mean, I don't have a choice. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know how not to represent. Like, how do you do that? How do you not rep where you're from and how you talk and you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know how not to do that. But, and as far as the memoir form, you know, I think it's kind of like with musicians too. I mean, I didn't come into it thinking, oh, let me, you know, expand the memoir form or play with, right. You know, you're not thinking like that at all. You're thinking.
But then you do.
Yeah. I mean, that's right? Like, it's great if you do that, but you definitely don't go in. I don't go in with that intention. My intention is more like, how do I best tell this story? Right. And then what I chose to do with this book is to tell it from the perspective of me at the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do something where it was like past tense, where I'm looking back and I'm like, I used to be like this. You know, right. I wanted to do something where it was like, you're put right in the moment, first person, present tense. You experience things as I experience them, you go through things as I go through them, the struggles, the pain, the epiphanies, all of that, you get to see how it all happens instead of me kind of reflecting and giving you kind of, you know, navigating you through it in that way. I wanted it to be like visceral and authentic and also really like urgent, a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because like she said in the intro about that bus not stopping, it's the book moves fast, but my life moves very fast. You know what I mean? Like one of the things that the book talks about, you know, is just growing up really fast, like just growing up real fast in a lot of different ways. And so that's how the narrative moves as well.
This is basically, you're covering the period from you're 12 years old at the beginning of the book to about what, 16, 17?
To about like 17, 18.
17,
like
18,
13
something
17,
like that.
17, 18, yeah.
Yeah. So you're covering actually a lot of ground, but it does move really fast. It's the kind of book that it's a page turner, right? Yeah. It's the kind of thing that you want to pick up and you just want to roll through it. What I thought was interesting too was that you gave voice to a lot of different folks. Like you deliberately decided to kind of include, for instance, your mom's journals.
Yeah.
And that I had so many questions just about your choice to do that. Yeah. But before that, I don't know how much you want to reveal about the book either, so just stop me, right?
Yeah, no, it's all good.
Okay. So your brother ends up basically running out with this car, with the stolen Johnny.
Yeah,
Johnny. Okay, Johnny.
Yeah.
Right?
Johnny, yeah.
Okay. So he's there in the car, and he gets basically caught by the police, and your parents send him away.
Yeah.
And this is basically the start of your spiral, your teenage rebellion, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, that moment really changed everything. You know, there's kind of a moment sometimes you can point to in your family when things started to go downhill, you know what I mean? And this story, my story, it's not just about things going downhill. It's also about things being rebuilt, right, and how they come together. But only through struggle, like Frederick Douglass said, without struggle, there's no progress, right? So only through struggle. But my brother gets arrested. He gets sent. My parents, you know, they don't know what to do with him, right? They're kind of like, you know, my dad is from one of 16 children from Valdosta, Georgia, right? Mm. He's picking cotton since he was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. My mom, you know, grew up in Brooklyn. She's from Bed-Stuy. You know, been working since she was 10, 11 years old, scrubbing floors for white people in Long Island. So they have a whole different mentality. They really don't understand, like, what's up with my brother? Like, why, yeah. You know, and even me to a certain extent at that time, even though I was younger, they're like, you know, you guys are getting trouble in school. So they decided to send him to Arizona to live with my uncle.
Right.
And my uncle was a recovering drug addict. And, mm-hmm. you know, he got his own, like, story. He could write a memoir, for real. like, everybody in this book could write a memoir, real talk. Like, they might not do it, but trust. Like, my story is the tip of the iceberg. So, anyway, he goes out there to live with him, and it just gets worse. You know, one thing about no matter where you are, if you looking for the trouble, you can find it in Arizona, in Idaho, no matter where you are. So they tried to send him somewhere that was very different than Philly, but he ended up getting in trouble out there, even like worse trouble. He got a statutory rape case, and it was with a white girl who was underage, you know, and, you know, there were so many layers to that. You know what I mean? Number one, you're in Arizona of all places. You know what I'm saying? So it's not really the place for that to go down, you know?
right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, number two, like you said, like even the complexity with, like, you know, my parents and their views on Afrocentricity and everything, that's complicated. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, so that was interesting. But anyway, that happens to my brother, and that's really the spiral effect. Like, my mom, you know, she suffered for depression for a long time, and she really just succumbed to mental illness, man. She was in, like, a fog for many years. And so what I did was I included my mom's journal entries in the book. My mom used to keep a diary, and I used to sneak and read her diary. And basically, it was the way that I, like, understood what was going on with her. And in her diary, she writes about me, about my brother, about my dad, about everything. I mean, deeply personal. The first diary entry I ever read was when she talks about how she tries to kill herself, right? And all the times throughout her life that she has tried to kill herself, and that she keeps, you know, even like in like her chair where she used to sit at, she always keeps like a hidden stash of pills just in case she wants to, she calls it check out, right? So I'm reading this as a kid, and, you know, this is how I, like, connected to my mom, and so especially when she went away. She went away, she was institutionalized. My dad, after that, ended up leaving, so it was just me and my mom, but my mom wasn't really, like, functional, so it was just me. And then I started gravitating toward, like, my brother's friends, the same guy who was like, yo, let's got the Johnny. Mm-hmm. Well, those are my homies now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can imagine for me being, like, 14, hanging out with them, it just was a bad look. but yeah, but the journal entries are really, and it was deep because I got in trouble for reading those journal entries when I was young. In fact, we had it's even seen in a book where my mom kicks me out the house. You know, part of it was because she found out that I was reading a journal and it was a problem. But what's crazy is when I was writing this book, I went back to her and I'm like, you know, I'm writing this memoir, and she's like, you should use my journal entry.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, really? Like, yo, but it's, you know, some of it's really, when I tell you, it's like heart-wrenching, and like some of the stuff, I mean, I'm talking about it very casually now, it's because I'm so familiar with everything, and it's just, it's my life, but when you read some of this stuff, you'll be like, I mean, wow, like, what she went through, what she was going through, her observations. My mom is also a beautiful writer.
Beautiful writer.
You know, I've had a couple interviews where people are like, you know you're, like, the second best writer in the family. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people, like, you know. And I'm like, yo, I hope mom gets a book deal. You know what I mean? But she's an amazing writer. And so, and she didn't never intended for these things to be read. And sometimes that's the best writing, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you don't think nobody's going to read this. And then, obviously, now you all get a chance to read it. So
it's a trip because the way you introduce it, right, is you're in your parents' bedroom and you're kind of going through their drawers. And you pull out your father's gun, right? And you kind of test with it, you play with it and that kind of thing. Then you put it down, and then you open your mom's drawer and you find her journals. But I thought it was interesting that you compared the journals to a gun in a way.
Yeah.
And that was going to be my question. Like, did she let you in? Clearly she did in this particular case. Why? What do you think motivated
mom,
her to do that? I mean, like... The one thing, too, to say is that it's like her voice is a real strong counterpoint. You're talking about the speed and the quickness that you're living life, 12 to 17, 12 to 18. And then your mom is going inside at this point. So there's a real interesting kind of counterpoint that's happening at the same time.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful contrast to me because, like you said, her voice is introspective. It's reflective, right? She's really... overstands the situation in a way, but at the same time is struggling with her own things as a woman, as a black woman, as someone who's in a marriage that's crumbling and falling apart, someone whose kids are wilding out, right? And so she's, so you get all this, and her voice is so different than mine. Her thing was this. My mom is, first of all, my mom's an artist. You know, she's a dancer, so she's really a true artist. And her other thing is that, you know, my story, she's like, my story, if someone reads my journal, I don't feel weak. I feel stronger because I've made it through all this. And also, it can help other people. Like, she wants to, you know, her thing was like, you know, especially in the black community, like, we don't talk about mental health issues. Like, we don't talk about depression and all those things. That's kind of like taboo. Like, you know, you just don't hear it. And what I realized, like, once I learned about, like, mental health and, like, stuff like that, I realized, like, that, like, most of the people in this book that I grew up with have, like, mental health issues.
And you draw it out.
Like, yeah,
you,
like,
actually draw it out in the characters.
Nobody knew it. Nobody talked about it. Like, but if you really look, and you read, how did this dude not have a mental, like,
that's
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But we're not getting treatment. We're not seeing, we don't have shrinks. Like,
that's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So
they're getting corner treatment, corner
therapy. Like, for
corner
real
therapy.
Like, yo, go get me another 40. Like, another one? Like, yeah, like, that's, you know. So anyway, but that's so my mom's whole thing was, through my story, first of all, it takes tremendous courage. Like I said, she talks about, you know, struggling, like, with suicide. She talks about addiction to drugs. She talks about her relationships, her failed relationships, her children. She talks about her scars, physical scars, her weight, all types of things that are deeply personal. And it takes so much courage to do that. I have so much respect for her for allowing me to do that. And also, you know, just like I said, just about being that, you know, sometimes you need, sometimes we all, every family goes through all these things, right? It's not like this is the first family, but sometimes you need to read someone else's story, to hear someone else's and how they dealt with it in order to give you your own family or your own self strength. Mm-hmm. And so I think what she wanted to do was inspire and encourage people and, you know, to tell their own stories and to kind of face their own demons. So
it pushes you a little farther too, right? Because then there's a critique of your dad that's kind of coming through, not just from your side, but from your mom's side.
Yeah.
And I guess part of it, one question I had about that was, is part of it kind of this, you know, generational critique that's happening as well, this critique of the folks who are so much about black power, Afrocentricity, that they weren't able to take care of their kids or protect their kids? Or is that reading too much into it?
Well, you know, the thing about it, as a kid, you're just a kid, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you just want to be, I'll read you some stuff about kind of like my dad and my brother. My dad and my brother had wars, you know, in a way. They were kind of like very too... they represented the opposite, like, you know what I mean? Like, they were like, and, you know, me as a little brother, I want to be like my brother, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But at the same time, have mad respect for my dad. And then my mom's critique, obviously, like, you know, as someone who's married to him and, you know, dealing with all of that, she's has her own thing. And I wanted to include her voice. I feel like I included my brother's voices, in here.
These letters from prison.
My brother's
and stuff.
Letters from jail are in the book as well. They're interwoven in. I have a sister who actually suffers from schizophrenia, and her letter, one of her letters is woven in as well, just to give that perspective. But yeah, let me read a little something about kind of like my dad and like my brother and that whole situation, and then kind of reflect a little bit on my thoughts.
Okay.
So I say, Pops is always preaching Afrocentricity. He was a Church of Christ minister way back when, one of those child preachers, and he still sounds like he's in the pulpit when he talks about black people, white people, and the struggle. I remember this debate he took me to at East Stroudsburg University a few years back. Him versus Cornel West versus Arthur Schlesinger.
That's his dad.
It was packed, standing room only. I remember how West, this cool black dude with a big afro and a tight three-piece suit, talked with his hands flying real fast like he was conducting an orchestra. And how Schlesinger, this old white guy with hair the color of milk and a red bow tie, sounded like a statue. I remember the cheers, the boos, the ad-libs. Most of all, though, I remember how dope my pops was, his passion, energy, confidence, intelligence. Half the time, I didn't even know what he was talking about. Hegemony, pedagogy, subverting a dominant paradigm. But I was proud. Back then, I didn't get it. But now I think I do. Afrocentricity basically means that black people should view the world through their own black eyes. It's like that poster my dad has framed in the hallway that says that people without knowledge of their past is like a tree with no roots. And then I have a quote. Hit the earth like a comet, invasion. Nas is like the Afrocentric Asian, half man, half amazing. Our crib is mad Afrocentric. Naked African statues standing everywhere, ritual mass ice grilling down from the walls, portraits of Martin, Malcolm, Harriet, from the wallpaper to the plates, everything stamped in Africa. Even my favorite porn series, My Baby Got Back, is made by a company called Afrocentric Productions. Beauties that give up the booty. The box under my bed says, Mr. Marcus, Lexington Steel, and loudmouth Wesley Pipes, nailing Nubian queens like Janet Jackme, Obsession, Midori, Monique, and Lacey Duvall in doggy style reverse cowgirl and missionary. So I tell my pops about the other Afrocentrics. And he's disgusted. Say what? But he's the one who's always talking about how black people should have their own stores, own banks, own schools. Shouldn't we have our own porn studios too? I mean, what's more Afrocentric than black pussy? Uzi doesn't really get down with Afrocentricity. I think he's still mad about the whole Star Wars thing from when we were little. Uzi used to love Star Wars, and he kept begging my parents for a Luke Skywalker action figure. Finally, my dad took him to Toys R Us. They came back. Uzi was heated. He got me Lando Calrissian, Uzi said. Who? Exactly. Nobody knows who he is. Lando Calrissian. Who that, I said. Fucking Billy D. Williams. Follow the corny black boy. He has no gun, no weapon, no special powers, and he talks like he's in a goddamn Colt 45 commercial. Like, the power of Colt 45 works every time.
Right.
They didn't have Luke, I asked. They had everybody, Luke, Obi-Wan, Han Solo, but Dad wouldn't get them because they're white. So it was interesting. Like, you know, there's always a lot of different influences. And like I said, my brother, you know, nowadays, like my brother, like we understand now, like what my parents were. My parents were different. Like my dad wore dashiki every day. You know what I mean? Like my friends are like, yo, why your pop always, is he from Africa? And I'm like, no, he's not from Africa, but he's kind of from, you know what I mean? Like, you're trying to explain to your 14, 15-year-old friends, you know, and they don't get it. They're just like, yo, your parents are mad weird, like, whatever. And as a kid, there's a part of you that just wants to be known. Like, why can't we celebrate Christmas? Like, why can't we just, you know, everybody got new clothes on Easter, you know what I'm saying? Like, why can't we just, you know, and then later on you realize, like, damn, my parents were actually, that was helpful, you know what I mean? Like, they were, you know, not allowing us to do certain things, you know, but back then, it was just like, yo, he got me Lando Calrissian, like, you know what I mean? Like,
so what did your dad think of the book?
Oh, I mean, you know, this was my dad's thing, because he's written two memoirs now, and his whole thing is like, You know, you have to be able to tell your story. You know, every what I realize is like every if you tell your story, and every like let's say even just the story of tonight, right? You leave out of here and everybody's like, oh, I went to see MK. Some of you would be like, you know, yo, it was dope. You know what I mean? Some of you would be like, oh, no, I didn't really, whatever, right? Whatever. No, you're not going to say that. But you'll be like, you know, you'll say, you'll have different memories of the event. Like, oh, yeah, remember that girl that was sitting? Oh, no, I don't remember her. Or, oh, remember Jeff? Remember when Jeff said the thing? And so what you realize when you write a memoir is that everyone kind of has a different account. So, like, my parents, they have, oh, I don't remember you did. Oh, yeah, well, you know, you weren't around. Or, you know, we did that behind your back. Or, you know, my brother, oh, when did that? You know, so there's always going to be, like, oh, when, you know, this, like, this particular part. Or, when, or, you know, people also have, like, a romanticization of, like, what, you know what I mean? So they'd be like, oh, I was around more. Or, you know, whatever it is. But he likes the book and he supports it. So that's important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, it's funny because you're talking, like, oh, yeah, you know, we went to the store and we stole some gum or something like that, you know, shoplifted some gum. But y'all were getting into some serious stuff.
Yeah, like, so, the book is definitely about, like, oh, in terms of me and my dad's relationship, the book is a lot about that. It's about mother and son with me and my mom and just how that plays out. It's very strong. It's about brother and brother, and it's about father and son. You know, me and my dad had a lot of headbutts, you know, like, especially, you know, when he left my mom, that just made me... I didn't like him. He didn't like. We just had issues, and we had real serious, deep issues. I had a lot of anger, like serious, crazy anger. And one day, the way it kind of climaxes or culminates is, I got locked up. I was hanging with my brother's friends, and we were down a place called J Street. And J Street is called Jefferson Street in Philly, and it was an open air drug market in the late '90s. So basically, like, you know. The cops don't mess with this area. You just go, you can get people literally, like how you know how people like sell newspapers and candy like on the street, like, hey, got your newspaper. That's how people sell drugs in this area. You know what I'm saying? It was like they just announced it. They got different type. They got glass cases, glass cases walking around with like full of like, you know what I mean? Like what you want. So anyway, I'm down J Street with my brother's friends who became my friends, who ended up joining a cult, which is also in the book and their whole story, getting out of the cult, becoming like hardcore drug addict. This is in the 90s, like promethazine, syrup, all that stuff is big now, pills. But back in the like, this was like 98, like Xanax and Oxycontins and promethazine, like, and what they would do is they would put the Xannies, two bars of Xannies in the syrup, shake it up, call it the Incredible Hulk. Right. And anyway, we're down there on the way back from this trip to J Street. One of them stabs the other one. I end up in the 35th precinct, which is the jail near where I live. So anyway, I call my cousin to get me out. She doesn't come. She's away at school or something. She calls my dad. My mom's not available. So calls my dad. My dad comes, and I hadn't seen my dad in a minute. You know, like, he had moved to an area called Levittown outside of Philadelphia. It's like, you know, I didn't...
Classic suburb, classic white suburb.
Not even. It's
But I mean, back then, when it was first formed.
Oh, right? Yeah, when it was first formed, it was, like, supposed to be, like, the suburb. But then it just, it's like, you know, like... white boys with mullets and you know what I mean? Like, and double exhaust pipes on their cars and shit. Like, that's how it is now. But anyway, he's out there and, you know what I'm talking about. So anyway, he's out there and I never went out to see him or anything, you know, and he didn't really come into Philly like that. And I didn't want to see him or whatever. So he comes to get me out of 35th Precinct and he's pissed at me just for being there, just for everything that is going on. I got kicked out of school and everything like that. So been just, you know, not on the right path. I remember I got all these tattoos when I was young. When I was 14, I got like a bunch of tattoos. So he'd be like, you know, he just didn't know. Like, he'd be like, oh yeah, I got this like a couple years ago. You know what I mean? Like he'd be like all surprised. But anyway, we're in the car and he's mad at me. I'm mad at him. And he's driving and he's like, you know what? He's like, it seems like you wanna fight me. Do you wanna fight me? And I was like, yeah, actually I do. Now we're on Broad Street, which is like the biggest street in Philly. It's like, I don't know. It's like being on Crenshaw or something. Like everybody, like people are out. Like it's, you know, people are outside. Like, so we're on Broad Street. He pulls a car with Broad and Erie in front of Checkers. And Checkers, y'all got Checkers out here? Like, yeah, okay. So pulls in front of Checkers And he gets out, and he's just like, got his, you know, got his little, I mean, I'm like, yo, I'm really about to fight my dad on Broad Street. And we ended up, you know, scrapping or whatever, and it ended with my dad on top of me, really pressing the words "I love you" into me and just telling me that he cares about me and he loves me. And you could just feel the anger, the pain, the love, everything. I had been in jail for that weekend, so I was hungry, and it was a soul food place like right across the street called Dwight's. So we went to Dwight's, you know what I'm saying? And we ate yams, macaroni and cheese, collard greens, all of that. And we just talked, you know, it was like the first real conversation we had. I felt like men, like, even though I was still like 17, but it was like a man-to-man conversation. Like, it was real, you know? And that was the beginning of, like, our new relationship, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And we grew a lot from that. The book actually ends. Damn, should I tell him, though?
Nah.
I'm going to just let that sit.
You should not. We got more surprises, so everybody's got to stay till the end of tonight, but you're going to have to get the book
and get him to sign it.
We got all kinds of surprises tonight.
Y'all don't even know.
That's right. Let's get to this part, though, because there's a lot that happens between 17 and 18, and at some point, words actually, in a lot of ways, save your life, right?
Yeah.
Did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do. So my mom OD'd. I was in Texas. I drove me and my friend, who was on the run, Jordan, we decided it would be a good idea, since he was on the run, we were 16, let's drive to Texas. I wish my cousin was here.
Because where else?
I know, right? My cousin from Funky Town, from Fort Worth, he's the one who told us, y'all fools need to come on down here, man, lay low. So y'all met my cousins. So they met my cousins a few weeks ago. But anyway, my cousin told us to come down there. So we drove down to Texas 25 hours straight from Philly. And we're just hanging out down there, like, you know. And but I got to call my mom, OD, she was in the hospital. So we drove back up to Philly. On the way back, we got pulled over. Jordan got arrested. You know, that's a whole nother memoir, a whole nother story. I went to see my mom. My mom was in the hospital. And we had a really interesting talk in the hospital. My mom talked about the last time she was happy and... I'm actually going to read you a little bit from that before I go to the blank page so you guys have a little bit of context. And also, like, before this whole scene, like, I had been kicked out of school. I've been kicked out of the house by my mom. So me and my mom had gone through a lot, but this is also, like, me and my mom's in the hospitals are kind of reunification. I asked her about when she was last happy. This is an alternative school? Well, I'm not this damn alternative. Like, take me to the pub. Like, take me back to the pub. Like, I want the regular school. Again, kind of like going back to my parents and, you know, this regular. Like, this, make you know, but again, you don't know at the time that what you're being exposed to is interesting. But anyway, I'm in this classroom one day, and I hadn't done schoolwork in, like, years at this point. I went to the schools that I was going to before this were, like, rote memorization, regurgitate. It was just copy the board. Like, there was no fights every class. Like, it was just complete chaos. So I wasn't really used to doing schoolwork. The teacher gives everybody blank pieces of paper, and she's like, write. Of course, I don't do it. I'm just sitting there. And then she comes over, and she's like, you know, I want you to write. And I'm like, doing all that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Going through, what you want me to write, yo? She's like, write anything you want. Anything I want, sure, okay, watch this. So I wrote fuck school, you know what I'm saying? Mm. Watch this, right? Watch this, write anything I want. She's like, good, now keep going. I'm like, what? This is crazy. Now I'm like, okay, but now she was so smart because, I mean, I wanted her to just kick me out of class. I just, you know, leave, go about my business. That's what I was waiting for. That's kind of how it always been. So when she challenged me to write more, I'm looking around at other people and they're writing, and I'm kind of wondering, like, dang, what's she writing? You know what I mean? Like, and I'm thinking about my own story. And anyway, it was a very, so I'm going to read you some moments from that space. I turn the blank page over. It's blank again. The blank page is the starter pistol that fires and triggers my mind to sprint. What will I write? What will I say? Will I say what I write? Write what I say? Something funny? Something serious? Something about my family, something about Amir, Ryan, How will I start? Whose story will I tell? My story? A story about a boy, maybe, from Philly? A lost boy who wants to find himself but doesn't know where to look? Who wants to tell his story but doesn't know where to begin or end? Who searches anyway and discovers something about himself, the world? I stare at the blank page, an ocean of white alive with possibility. I hear myself take a breath, then exhale, deep, like I just rose from underwater. It's like I'm at the free throw line again, foul shots, like the game is on the line, again. I remember something my dad told me, shoot to make it. My hand shaking, trembling like it's freezing. Then it hits me, a silence louder than all the music I've heard in my life. All the light in the world in one beam before me. I grip the pen and something shoots down my spine, sits me straight up. Then the pen feels heavy, like it's made of stone. I stare deep into the blank page and see myself. I feel something I've never felt before, purpose. I don't know what my exact purpose is yet, but I know it has something to do with this pen and this blank page. I am a blank page. Holding the pen this way, snug and firm in my fists, makes me feel like I can write my future, spell out my destiny in sharp strokes. So that actually, like, that ignited me. Like, writing ignited me. At first, I couldn't write anything, and I definitely didn't share anything in the class. It took me a while to, like, even just for the pen to start moving, I was just kind of stuck. It was like my pen was in ice. I just couldn't write anything. Then after a while, like, I started to really take to this class. I started to stay after school just to, like, mess around and write. I told the teacher, like, yeah, I want to be a writer. She's like, we got to be a good reader. She started giving me books. I started reading a book a day in high school, at the end of my high school career. You know, my relationship with my dad got better. He started giving me books. Like, you know, my teacher would be giving me certain kinds of books. Like, the first book that I read, the first writers that I really read were, like, the Beat Generation writers. Like on the road, Jack Kerouac, Ginsberg, all of those cats. And the reason why I think I gravitated towards those guys is because they were rebels, number one. You know what I mean? They were rebellious. And they wrote about things I didn't even know you could write about. I didn't know you could write about drugs and sex and stuff like that. You know what I mean? In school, you only learn, you know, certain authors, so you don't get exposed to it. So I'm like, damn, you can write like that? And then the thing that they were saying, things I could relate to. And then they had their own style. They were influenced by jazz in the same way that I was influenced by hip hop. So I connected with them. But then my dad would get, you know, when I started reading, I mean, again, I was devouring books. I started to realize why it was illegal for black people to read in the first place during slavery. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, during slavery, you always hear that, oh, it's illegal for black people to read. But you never really know why. I didn't know why until I started reading. You know what I mean? Realizing that, damn, I think in words. We sub-vocalize all the time. So if you limit someone's words, you limit their thoughts. Mm-hmm. You limit, they can't even, you know, you know what I'm saying? They can't even think about freedom because they don't have the words to do so. So that made me even be more voracious about my reading. My dad would give me books like, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois and Asada and Malcolm and stuff like that. So I was getting, you know, the Ginsberg and the Kerouac and, you know, that kind of thing, you know, with the Malcolm and the Asada. And so it was really making me who I am today in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, that was the beginning, the blank page.
Let's open it up for some questions.
Yeah, let's do it.
We have time for a few questions. But yeah, M.K. Asante. Just raise your hand if you have a question. We have a few microphones out here.
This is for both of you as professors. How do you determine your hip-hop syllabus, and how contemporary do you get, and why?
Are you trying to put your syllabus together right now? Because I know I have to go home and do that, so.
My son teaches a hip-hop course.
Oh, okay.
Cool. Well, I just use his book. Let's call it a day. So.
And I'm going to start just using his book now that I got it. So.
But everybody has a different... Hip-hop is so big and so broad and so expansive, and there's so many ways you can take a hip-hop class that it really depends in terms of what you're doing. I think if you want to reach students in a particular way and for it to be relevant, you definitely have to get as contemporary as... like a minute ago, you know what I'm saying? But you also have to, you know, obviously impart them with the history of hip hop and where it comes from and understanding the culture. So then you have to go all the way back. So, and I'm not talking about even at the beginning of hip hop. You know what I mean? I'm talking really the beginning when that first ship came to America. Like, that's when hip hop started. You know what I'm saying? So you have to go back and really, just so that they understand, like, that hip hop wasn't created in a vacuum. Like, this is a part of, like, cultural legacy and, you know, resistance, and just kind of they can get a full picture. So I like to start back as far as possible and you know, be as contemporary as like I said, like 30 seconds ago. But, you know, that's me.
I agree. I think the cool thing about using hip hop in the classroom is that you actually have to end up becoming a learner at some point too, because I mean, face it, you know, we're, we're not on top of every other, you know, 17-year-old, 18-year-old who's coming up now.
They're like, so, yo, you heard of...
Exactly.
Like, we'll be like, I never heard it. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
so, you know, classic is first class. I'm like, all right, what is Ratchet? And then we have a whole conversation on Ratchet, you know, and then that's great, because then it shapes like the whole thing, because it's a good reversal to have to be the teacher who's actually have to be the learner.
Yeah.
And then there's a dialogue that actually is happening in that gap. So.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Wendy. First of all, I think it's incredible to have this conversation here at the library. And I'm curious. Yeah, it's awesome.
Definitely.
I'm curious as to your thoughts on the current status of hip hop, mainstream hip hop, and the message behind the lyrics of some of the most prominent music of today.
Word. Well, you know, like, that's obviously a huge conversation and all that stuff. But I'll just say this, honestly. You know, I really believe that hip hop is entering a renaissance phase. You know, I mean, everything comes back. Everything is cyclical. You know what I mean? So we see these cycles. Snapbacks are back. You know, Gumbies are back. Arsenio is back. You know what I'm saying? Like, everything is coming back. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so part of that comeback, the way I see it, is the return to lyricism, the return to substance in hip hop. And so it's real. It's like picking low hanging fruit. It's too easy for me to just talk about, you know, how messed up the game is, and where you, but I'm talking about what's about to happen and what's already happening. Like, there's a renaissance that's taking place, and, you know, I feel honored to be a part of it. Cats, like, we have some amazing cats in the audience today, you know what I mean? Legendary hip-hop artist Raz Kaz. I mean, you talk about someone who's been doing this for for so long and has kept the bar so high and has done so much for hip-hop. We got Raz in the audience today. We got Bishop Lamont in the audience. I mean, these cats are part of the renaissance that I'm talking about. You know what I'm saying? Yep. Like, there's, you know, and I think you can see it. I mean, even with the art, like, out of here, Kendrick Lamar and Absol and these people, like, you see that there's a renaissance taking place, and there is a return, and people are starting to appreciate the lyrics and the substance more. And so I think, you know, it's easy to focus on the negative, obviously. That's, you know, I mean, just turn on TV, listen to the radio. I mean, you hear it, you see it, we all see it. But what you don't necessarily see is that renaissance that's about to take over. And so that's what, you know, that's what I represent.
Ditto. Yeah.
Hi.
Hey, what's up?
It's so great to hear both of you speak. And I was wondering, you talk a lot about how your father affected your writing. Since you've become a father, how has that affected your writing?
Wow.
That's a good question. Less time to write. Simple as that. You know what I mean? Well, you got to be more effective in the time that you do have to write. You know what I'm saying? Like, before, you know, maybe I could just waste 8 hours just thinking about an idea, you know what I mean? But now I might have like 45 minutes and I gotta bang it out. You know what I mean? No, you don't have time to just be, you know, so it's just less time, man.
But beyond the time though, like, how has it changed your...
It hasn't hit me. Because
really?
If I would have, nah, because...
You don't have like a...
Nah,
I mean,
my son was like one when I was writing this, so if I was writing this thinking about him, like, it would be like... I wasn't really thinking he would read this for a long time. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, because, like, he's a baby. So, like, it wasn't...
He'll probably start reading it at 10 or 11.
Yeah, if you're writing and your kid can actually read what you're writing. You know what I'm saying? But he can't read it yet, you know, even though he knows a couple things now. But
right.
But yeah, but just less time, I guess. And, you know, I think it hasn't. But in terms of the substance, I'm not sure.
If I may, I think there's another question there, too, right? Because you had this book that came out, you know, It's Bigger Than Hip Hop, The Post-Hip Hop Generation.
Yeah.
You know, have you started thinking about sort of what your responsibility is, if you think of it as responsibility to, you know, the students that you have coming into your classes, as well as the generation that your kid is going to be in as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's something I think about all the time. I think, you know, I want to, exposure is key. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's something. I teach in Baltimore City, Morgan State University, historically black college. So we all know what Ratchet is. So exposure. You know, one thing that I find is just that, like, you know, even in my education, you know, because Buck is about education. It's about miseducation, re-education, street education, self-education. It's about the difference and the distance between school and education, all of that. But one thing that I realize is that the people just aren't exposed, you know? And so one of the things I want in my class, like, I don't even feel like you said, teacher-learner thing. Like, that's always a constant back and forth to me. Like, okay, yeah, I'm a professor, but I'm really just a student, just fronting as a professor. Like, I'm really just learning. I'm really just exposing you to the things that I think are interesting and creating dialogue about it. Because a lot of times people just aren't exposed. And, like, you know, I had this student, this black girl from Baltimore, right? And she was, I went to graduate school out here, I went to UCLA. I went back to Baltimore and I'm teaching this black girl from Baltimore and she's an amazing writer, right? And I said, well, what do you want to do with this? You know, she said, well, you know, my dream would be to go to like a grad school, but I'm not good enough. You know, I don't, and I'm like, what you mean you're not good enough? She's like, I'm not good enough. You know, I come from here and I don't have this. And, you know, I'm like, yo, so I had to, first of all, explain to her how amazing she was as a writer, right? She didn't know. She really was in the dark. I'm like, yo, you're amazing. So I convinced her, kind of. And I'm like, you know what? I'm like, do you even know about the programs? And she didn't know anything about the program. All right, so boom. Talk about the programs, MFA, all of this stuff. She ends up getting a full ride to Columbia University. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is like... It's just the exposure, though. You know, she didn't even know about that world and about that was even possible. That wasn't even in her reality. So exposure, and that's just one example, obviously, just informational, you know, knowledge, that kind of thing. But just exposure, though, that's key. And I also feel like because I'm close in age to my students and because I'm doing a lot of the things that they want to do, you know, we can have real conversations about how to, because sometimes school is all theoretical. You know what I mean? And that's all good and everything, but you got kids out here who are coming from situations and they really need like pragmatic, practical things that they can get into and ways that they can navigate this world. So I think it's cool that we can build and plan about, okay, strategically, what are you trying to do? Let's figure out how to do it. You know what I mean? So that's what I feel like I'm there for as well.
I think we got time for one more quick question.
So I was wondering about your decision to write a memoir. I've read other interviews with authors like Angela Davis and others who, you know, when they talked about the decision to write, they said that they were kind of hesitant because of their age, you know, being young and not really having fully lived yet. And so I'm wondering what made you decide to write the memoir about the period that you did and to write it at all. So
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I got a question for y'all. Do you have a story in your mind or an idea in your mind that you're kind of scared of a little bit? Like when you think about it, you're like, oh man, I don't know if they're ready for that one. Like you don't know if you're ready for that one. It's kind of the thing that might scare you a little bit, but at the same time it excites you and you know that something's calling you about it. You guys, you know what I'm saying? Cool. So yeah, like, so that's kind of how Buck was for me in a sense. First of all, the title, Buck. Young Buck, Buck Wild, Buck Shots, Buck Town, Black Buck, Slave Buck, Make Buck, Buck Now. Buck is a loaded meaning. Like, it's so many meanings to Buck. You know, Young Buck, that's what we say in Philly. Buck Shots in the air. To go Buck Wild, that's what I was doing. You know, to buck the system, which is what Buck is really about. When you get to the heart and the core of Buck, it's about bucking the system and not being a statistic and not just, you know, following blindly behind these whatever. So anyway, but to the question. So I decided this story was the one that was like I was scared of to some extent, you know? It was like, I was kind of fearful because, first of all, you're so vulnerable, you know what I mean? Like, writing about that time, and then from that perspective, and then your family, and then your friends, and all that, it's just, there's a vulnerability. You open yourself up. Like, you guys are going to read my story and feel like y'all know, like, y'all really know me, you know what I mean? Like, hey, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's making yourself vulnerable. It's scary to even revisit those things. And that's why I had to do it. You know what I mean? Like, because that's where the substance is. That's where the soul is. You know what I mean? Soul is the graceful survival against impossible circumstances. That's where the soul is. And the thing that makes you nervous, and the thing that you're like, oh my God, you know, that's where the story is. And also, the reason why is because that was the most difficult time in my life. You know what I'm saying? Like, those years were the most challenging. You know what I mean? Like, my life hasn't been a breeze since then, but those years were definitely the most challenging in terms of family perspective, what was going on in my neighborhood, in my community, with my friends, education, everything, like all of that. So it was like, and to understand who I am now and to inspire young people, like I wrote this for all the young bucks out there, you know what I'm saying? And to inspire them and know like where I came from, because I want them to understand like that, you know, it's a process, you know, it's an evolution, it's a journey, it's a struggle. Like, things aren't always just sweet. Like, it doesn't, people sometimes think that, oh, you know, it just must be easy to do it. But no, it's a journey, and I wanted people to get inspiration from the struggle and then also from the progress, like where we came from, and to kind of see that journey. And I felt like also, it's an amazing story, you know what I mean, on so many levels. Like, the people, the characters from my life, the people who I grew up with are amazing, interesting, fascinating people, like on every level, not just my family, but the people in my circle. Like, and in a lot of ways, I wanted them to live forever, you know? And so I think through these pages, they do.
All right. Cool. Actually, I think we're out of time for questions. We'll have time. There's gonna be a book signing outside, so it's a good time for you to catch up with MK
Damn, y'all
directly.
Just gonna do it like that?
Hey man,
we gotta. You want to ask real quick?
Really, we got okay. Oh, sorry.
I'm trying to get to the surprise.
All right, okay, cool.
Okay,
do your thing.
Just quick question.
Y'all just snatched it out of her. You know what I mean? She was already.
Hey,
she was
I have
already.
My
yo, she's been thinking about this question for like, you know what I mean, 10 minutes. All right,
my bad.
Now, tell me this: why should someone who's not in their 20s or black or from an urban area care about
hip-hop? This is not going to be a short one.
No, it's real easy, actually. Real
oh,
easy.
Okay.
Because when you tell your story honestly, no matter where you got, Maya Angelou told me this. I went to see Maya Angelou. I was struggling with my book. I went to see her. She's my mentor. I went to see her. I said, I'm struggling with my book, Buck. He said, tell the truth. When you tell the truth, it resonates with a white woman in Ohio. Resonates with an Indian man. It resonates with... The truth is... universal. What my mom went through, what I went through in terms of rebellion or pain or loss or education, observation, all these things are universal. So regardless of where you're from, there's these great truths and profound insights that we can take from anyone's story. That's why, I mean, we talked about hip-hop. That's the power of hip-hop. Mm-hmm. A kid living in a whole another part of the world who's never seen a city, never seen a ghetto, never seen a black person. It's like, you know what I mean? Because there's something universal about the truth.
Yeah. Damn. Damn.
Now.
Nice. All right.
Now. Appreciate you.
Going on in it. So right. What I want from y'all is, like, we're going to give you a real hip-hop concert. It's going to be like Rock the Bells, but inside the library.
Right.
So
Rock
some of
the books. Rock
so,
the books.
You know what I'm saying? Some of y'all can get your hands up like this.
Rock the books.
Some of y'all be like this, rock like, yeah, butt. Yeah. Then when you at a hip-hop concert, a lot of people come see you and be mad. So then they got their arms crossed.
Right.
Some of y'all can cross your arms. You know what I'm saying? And just be like, nah, son, I'm better than that. He whack.
All right.
And then other people can pump their fists. So we're going to get into it. We just want y'all to have fun. This is God's in the Hood.
God's
in the library
in the
for the first time.
In the library.
Oh, and I forgot. This is the first time we ever performing it, so we're gonna need y'all
to bear with us.
That too. And when we get to the hook, we're gonna be like
When I say read, y'all say book.
Read up. Wu-Tang.
Let's go.
Hey yo, Russ.
Break that science down, son.
Throw my two cents in. We'll make it 5%. Then, if black man is God, then the ghetto must be heaven. Under fire, holy war against the racists or the devil or the non-believing atheists that restrict us to this level yard where there's guards or street level where there's no cross guards, so the children get crossed, get lost and struck by vehicles with no Carfax. These type of rides can't buy at a CarMax. Self-hatred from hatred. The process is ancient. Ignorance, violence, innocence, they take it. She once was a high priestess in a temple so sacred. And now anyone can enter, desecrate it. We went from pyramids to cribs, from Amun Ra to niggas that be rah-rah. Grown men continuing a curse, a curious case of Benjamin Button, living life in reverse.
Y'all say read up, y'all say book, read up, read up. When I say read up, y'all say book, read up.
That's hard.
Read up, book. When I say hip, y'all say hop, hip, hip. When I say hip, y'all say hop, hip.
That's hard.
Hip.
Get it. Transforming from old dog to mole god. MK Asante with a flow job. Create a mech in the ghetto, what is your hodge? Pilgrimage is killing kids with some no lodge. Mathematics and knowledge, what is your prop? Making our youth dumber than a fucking doorknob.
Get up!
Elastic brains with white shit, that's a snow job.
Yeah.
Discovered by little shorties while still in 40s.
I feel sorry for your mother.
Fuck you talking about? You moved west late 50s, black migration from the south.
Yeah.
The best sort of Louisiana with my grandpa and grandma. Granny, seven sisters, three brothers. Dreams of less discrimination, better education. We Cali natives, first generation. Watchtowers, wilted flowers. A lot of us don't make it to adults, succumbing to white power. Tattooing they face, what a young nigga do? What about when you 28 on a job interview?
Message.
My brothers and sisters, followers instead of leaders. Rich chicks with a bad attitude, it's called a diva. But a broke chick with a bad attitude, just called a stupid bitch. I'll preach if you insist.
I insist.
Consequences and repercussions when the boys turn them in into self-destruction.
Message.
When I say Rita, y'all say book. Rita, Rita. When I say Rita, y'all say book. Rita, Rita.
Guys
education.
In the hood, trapped in facades in the hood. Always getting even, cause what's the odds in the hood? So we mob, so misunderstood, we overstand. City of applause, clapping like it's Pakistan. Rosewood to Rosecrans, young boys on a Conan. Freedom or death, not a slogan. Like the nature of the threat ain't a slow jam. My Elohim's off that wet through them badlands. Black cinematics, so visual. And if it's gods in the ghetto, this the ritual. Children of the night, candlelight, the vigil. Smoke a L with Ellison, now we visible.
Word.
Something out of nothing, maximize the minimal.
Come on.
Prison and dust, turning gods into criminals. Forcing us to revise these spirituals. For your mental, reviving our pinnacle.
What's up, make some noise.
Oh, 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 oh.
One love. Thank you, Em.
Thank you for having
Word
me.
Word library has been so real. After party, after party in the library, mad books to read.
Yo, thank you all.
Yo, thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.